Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Stanley Greenberg, a veteran pollster for Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and Nelson Mandela, among other world leaders. He believes that the much sought-after center in American politics is a myth, and that the independent voter is an illusion. Given that the Obama administration's strategy seems to be to continually reach out to the center, this could spell trouble for them. Then we will speak with Dr. Kevin Casas-Zamora, who is the former vice president of Costa Rica and a senior fellow in foreign policy in Brookings Latin American Initiative. We will discuss the deteriorating health of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and what is expected to be a furious power struggle to succeed him, given the lack of transparency about succession and the highly polarized political battle lines in Venezuela. Then finally, we'll speak with British documentarian Nick Broomfield, whose latest documentary feature, Sarah Palin, You Betcha, opens in theaters tomorrow. He and his co-director, Joan Churchill, have spent months in Wasilla, Alaska, talking to family, friends, and former friends and co-workers of the former beauty queen, who, in spite of her efforts to deny ugly charges about who she actually is, still might run for president. Joining us now is Stanley Greenberg, who was a pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, South African President Nelson Mandela, amongst other prominent world leaders. He is the co-founder with James Carville of Democracy Corps and the chairman and CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rossiter Research. He was recently interviewed in New York Magazine in an article, The Elusive Indie. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stanley Greenberg.
I'm delighted to be here to talk about this very important subject.
And it is very important because it seems to be the centerpiece of President Obama's, not just his re-election strategy, but his political strategy. At least that's what we're told, is that he is trying to reach out to the independents in the center. It's often quoted that he is trying to be the adult in the room. So you're sort of exploding the myth that this very center exists.
God, I apologize. You know, the myth is much better and it's actually much more interesting if you can believe in the myth, that there's this generic independent voter that, out there who's, reasoned, sitting back, ready to vote for the most, adult-like, reasonable, bipartisan, leader, ready to cut entitlements. That's the kind of leader they're looking for. In fact, as, I indicated in the interview that was parallel the Frank Rich piece. This is a very diverse group of people. And there are, parts of it that are, anti-party and politics and looking, for that. But there are lots of other parts of other strands that run through the independent world that, make this a much more, unfortunately, complicated, answer.
Well, but what you say, Stanley Greenberg, is that contrary to the myth that the independents are more educated, ideologically moderate, studious, read up on the issues, come to consider judgments, you're saying in truth independent voters are less engaged and less informed.
This is true. They're usually get involved later in the process. And also some of this is even, just methodologically deceptive because because they get involved later. When you do a survey right now, it's shaped by, who does a survey at this time. And earlier in the process, the strong partisans, will do it. As you get later into the election and much closer to the election, the independents are more likely to participate. So it's very much, shaped by when you conduct, the survey.
So, Stanley Greenberg, is this notion of the virtue of the center and the virtue of the moderate, does this come out of a kind of, we have a convention in the press, unlike the European press and the rest of the world that is usually ideological and polarized, we have this notion of fairness and balance, which of course Fox News have somewhat abused. But the long and the short of it is, the idea that it's virtuous to be a centrist, that you give the pro, the con, and then a kind of meaningless mush. I mean, the truth of the matter is that convention in journalism didn't come about because of fairness. It came about because advertisers and media owners didn't want to offend anybody. So they just appealed to both sides.
Well, one of my big gripes is not, right at the center of this subject, but one of my great gripes is that there's a assumption that this is all reciprocal, that whatever's happening on the Republican side is also happening on the Democratic side. And so if you listen to the media, they will say, tis-tis. You know, the Republicans are, you know, refusing to compromise, and they're very, you know, very conservative and very, you know, polarized. And similarly, the Democrats very liberal and unwilling to compromise, and that this is a similar, you know, process on both sides, and the independents are growing and upset, disgusted with the whole thing. Now, the problem all is this is true on the Republican side. And I'm saying this, by the way, not in terms of characterizing their behavior. I'm talking about real data. You know, if you ask Republicans what's their ideology, heavily 75 to 80% of Republicans will describe themselves as conservatives. And that's grown, you know, over the course of the last decade. On the Democratic side, if you ask that same question, only one-third self-describe as liberals. Two-thirds of people who call themselves Democrats are either describe themselves as moderate or conservative. So the idea that the moderates are in the center, the fact is the Democrats are a very diverse coalition, you know, regionally diverse, demographically diverse, ideologically diverse, and much more divided than the trend we're talking about is mainly a Republican, you know, trend. And many of the views of moderate, you know, Democrats, you know, do share, you know, lap over, you know, into the independents.
Well, I think the bankruptcy, though, of this binary idea of equal arguments and equal time was most manifest during the threat to shut down the government over the debt ceiling extortion, in effect, it was. And one side was doing the extorting. However, the way it was presented in the press, exactly the way that you described it, was that it was just both sides were equally to blame. But it's also, I think, affected the debate on climate change, where, you know, phony oil company paid for so-called research is given equal weight to 99% of the world's climatologists. And creationism is equated with evolution. So I guess it's another discussion, but let's get...
I could not, you know, agree with you more. Now, there is, you know, look, some of this is the media and punditry, but some of it's also the obligation, you know, of leaders to, you know, to clarify the issues. The president... who I support and I'm doing everything possible for him to succeed, needs to be educative and has become much more educative in the last couple months as they turned to the jobs bill. But the president has to put the spotlight on the Tea Party and the House Republicans when you get to that, you know, the brink, you know, on the debt limit in order for the country to know what happened and what the stakes are. And that's, you know, and that's a question of the Democrats, not just nationally. You know, not just joining these issues, but also, you know, playing a much, being much more articulate about the stakes and who's responsible.
Again, I'm speaking with Stanley Greenberg, who is a pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, South African President Nelson Mandela, and many more world leaders. And we're talking about the elusive independence or the myth of the center, if you will. Now, does this mean that in this upcoming election year, for the president, who Axelrod recently acknowledged it would be a titanic struggle, and I think that, you know, there's been lots of discussion in the press, well, you know, Obama would be better off running against Perry than he would against candidate Mitt Romney. But the long and the short of it is that I guess, in a way, what he has to run against, he's got to run against somebody. And they've got the advantage now because they're having all these endless debates. Do you think until he has somebody to run against, he's kind of in flux?
There are things that one can do to be able to, you know, set the table for the choice you're going to, you know, to have. There's a big choice in the election. It's become, you know, apparent, you know, piece by piece here. I think it's gotten much clearer in the last month as the president has laid out his jobs bill and his long-term, you know, deficit plan. And as the Republican nominating process goes forward, as the public hears what they say, that impacts, you know, and the president has to pose a choice, and he's already doing it, and it's more and more he's doing it, and it's going to lead into a big choice about the future. And, you know, if you look at the Republican primary, I mean, right now Romney looks moderate, you know, on Social Security relative to Perry, who's talking about Social Security, the Ponzi scheme, but Romney's talking about Social Security privatization. So, the range of options here within the Republican primary process is privatization, you know, versus Ponzi scheme. And so that's not going to fly. And one of the, yeah, to be honest, one of the big swing voters, in this, in these last elections, have been seniors, you know, that are, you know, could be greatly impacted by the growing Republican determination to, you know, cut what they call entitlements. You know, so there, I mean, there are swing voters. They're, you know, heavily include seniors. It includes the more affluent suburbs. It includes, many white blue collar workers. They're very different, but, you know, and their swing have been very, you know, swing, from election to election. The president, they're, all of them for various reasons have been tough for the president, which is why he's not done well, with independents of late. You know, but, they, for various reasons, when they face a real choice, can begin to erode, you know, what the Republican position.
But why do you think that the president and a lot of Democrats are afraid of populism when it seems pretty clear on the record that the Republicans, in order to win, have to get Democratic votes, and they try to appeal to these blue collar white Democrats as populists. The Sarah Palin, I'm just, you know, I'm a regular working person. John Boehner, I wash the floor in my father's bar. They go out of their way to seem like ordinary folks and not shills for billionaires and millionaires. And I don't understand the fear of full-throated populism on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and nothing actually scares them more than when they come out with accusations about Democrats waging class warfare. That's, you know, that's exactly what they're fearful of. That Democrats will, you know, pose this as a real choice that focuses on helping the middle class and making sure the wealthy and special interests contribute to, you know, any future solution. And it's a very powerful piece. And I've watched this. You know, it's a bit like climate change. You can put the facts out there, and there's a presumption against it that runs through the media. And, you know, as well as the political class, and I'm sure there's tremendous pressure on the economic side as well. But if you look at the last election, the last debate in the last 3 weeks of the election was about Joe the Plumber. You know, it's not the way I would have framed the debate when the president, you know, spoke about, you know, needing, you know, to move money around, redistribute wealth. And you ended up having McCain raising Joe the Plumber continuously in the debate, bringing Joe the Plumber on the campaign trail, ads running on Joe, and that was an argument that if you raise taxes on the wealthy, it's going to hurt the small business and the middle class. It was a very explicit argument, and Obama's lead in that period went up steadily on who you trust on the economy, went up steadily on who you trust on taxes, and it went up on who you trust on this argument. And so we have a real life test. We know the power of this, but there's tremendous pressure not to use it. And I've watched it in campaigns. I've worked with Paul Begala and others, and I tend to come at my populism in a little bit different way, a little bit more inclusive populism, but we basically operate in a similar framework. And there's tremendous pushback, against it. But I say put the data on the table. I have no doubt that this is the most powerful way to approach the election.
And we know, Stanley Greenberg, that the president has a very disaffected progressive and liberal base. I mean, that seems to be smoldering. What do you think he can do to reinvigorate those people? Because, you know, he did... obviously, the figures are pretty stark. In 2008, I believe 140 million voted, and the Democrats got swept in. They got the trifecta. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, a little more than half voted, 85 million, and the Republicans swept in the House and picked up gains in the Senate.
Well, I mean, look, it's hard to deny that, you know, the data on this and our own, you know, our own survey that we released last week on the 60 Republican battleground seats that mostly Obama had won in 2008, that there was a significant drop in his job approval rating amongst Democrats. So that we know there's an issue, and there are other polls, you know, that have have shown that. But it's also lots of evidence that there's been movement, that the president gets it. That there's lots of evidence that the path he's on right now reflects a consciousness of that. And so it's the piece that I'm less worried about. I mean, I think the president gets it, and and I think there's lots of evidence that he's moving on this.
But isn't there, according to your research, it seems that you're saying that non-college whites are very populist, and older non-college graduate seniors are more populist than any other segment of the electorate. They're also nationalistic and anti-immigrant, mm-hmm. yeah. as well as being anti-war.
Populism is an effective strategy for independence. So the idea that if you battle for the middle class, and battle for those people who struggled, most in this recession, and frankly, who've seen their incomes decline, over the last decade, that battle is that's the central battle for winning independence. Now, there's other seniors are also a significant, piece of this. And they are less educated than, the generations that have come, that are coming on now. And very, very financially, greatly worried, given, what's happening with the economy, what's happening with their own retirement, funds, many, forced back into work. They don't understand China. They don't understand why we're SAPs and don't stem. And so that they are, quite ready to respond to a populism and more nationalist appeal. Don't know whether it's probably not the route that the president takes, but they are, a large portion of the independents, are accessible within this more populist framework. And the idea that this is a turn away from independence just is a misread of who they are.
Right, but doesn't that pose a real problem for the president? He can't be a nationalistic, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, whereas Rick Perry can.
No, that's right. I mean, that's why, to be honest, winning blue-collar voters is going to be tough. I mean, these voters turned away. They hung in with the Republicans and with George Bush post 9/11, and he ran a campaign against Kerry's elitism. That reinforced that, and Bush had a big win with white blue collar, white non-college voters, but they decided in 2006 and 2008 that the Bush economy had nothing in it for them. They reacted strongly against the Republicans and with the economic crisis, the financial crisis. But they are one of the biggest groups to turn away from the president in 2010, as they saw very little recovery for themselves, if anything worse, and that's the toughest battleground. And you're right, a populist Republican candidate like a Perry, could indeed have appeal to those voters. And so while it is true that they may drive away some independents, maybe they'll drive away seniors who are nervous about, his views of Social Security, and they may drive away the more affluent suburban voters, which are very important in the independent space. And so there's, but a Perry, plays there.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, do you think, back to the Stanley Greenberg, back to the disaffected and disillusioned progressives, mm-hmm. There's rumors and some people are floating ideas of running a primary challenge. It's getting a little late in the day for that, but mm-hmm. but nevertheless, the talk is out there. Do mm-hmm. you think it's likely, and given what happened to Jimmy Carter with Teddy Kennedy, will it have a similar damaging effect?
Look, you don't want a primary. And I wrote, and James Carville and I, when we wrote about this, some months ago, when we talked, when we were beginning to hit wrong track numbers that were in the mid-70s, and right direction in the 20s, we began writing, when you have this level of disaffection, stuff is just going to happen that you're just not going to expect. Who knew that in 92 that even, with a Ross Perot, until late in the process, when you have that kind of discontent, stuff happens. And you look at the Buchanan, this is not Teddy Kennedy. I mean, for all, of the weakening, the president, is quite strong with Democrats. He needs to be stronger. But it's, no primary challenger is going to succeed. Or get anything like a Ted, a Ted Kennedy. But, Pat Buchanan made it harder, for, George Bush, the father. So frivolous, primaries, can have an effect. You don't need it. Hopefully that won't happen.
But you do say, Stanley Greenberg, that somebody will run as an independent in 2012.
Well, you could have, there's too much space here. There's too much, when this, process, we'll see, what happens when the Democratic side begins to close down, which is, which effectively is closed down, but there could be mischievous things. The Republican gets, they are very polarized primary. Whether you pick a Romney or, a Perry or whomever else comes into this, there's a real possibility of, disaffection that opens up the space for an independent, candidate in that space.
So if the right wing,
if there were a Ross Perot, out there, it's a little harder. Ross Perot kind of is the best profile of this, but Trump is, Trump doesn't fit it because he's, he looks like he's like part of the financial, world. Making your fame and fortune under firing people is not exactly the best profile for this, this kind of election year. But it looks, a businessman who's not part of this, mess, who wants to, in this case, there is a space for an anti-party, anti-politician candidate who can capture, some of the, populist energy out there.
So just in closing then, if the Republicans do, and the primary voters, of course, are further to the right, if they do choose a Perry, that could open up a space for somebody like a Bloomberg.
Yes.
Well,
he says no, but but who knows?
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us, Stanley Greenberg. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Stanley Greenberg, who was a pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, South African President Nelson Mandela, and a number of other world leaders. He's the co-founder with James Carville of Democracy Corps and the chairman and CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. He has an article recently where he's interviewed in the New York Magazine titled "The Elusive Indie." We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former vice president of Costa Rica about the health of Hugo Chavez. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Kevin Casasamora, who's a senior fellow in foreign policy in the Brookings Latin American Initiative. Most recently, he served as Costa Rica's vice president, as well as minister of national planning and economic policy. Dr. Casasamora has authored several studies on political finance, elections, democratization, and civil-military relations in Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kevin Casasamora.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
And clearly the health of President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has been deteriorating. There's a lot of secrecy surrounding it. He's had several bouts of radiation therapy in Cuba, as much as we know. But a report some months ago said that he had prostate cancer that had metastasized into his pelvis, and it seems that the treatment he's getting now would indicate that the cancer has spread.
The real question here, Ian, is that nobody knows. You know, I wouldn't be able to say whether that's a fair description or not, because the information about the health of President Chavez has been kept under wraps, and that in itself is obviously a sign of a something that is, quite frankly, you know, not compatible with a full democratic regime. I mean, a full democratic regime, those things are you know, a matter of public discussion, because they have implications for the life of the country. Obviously, that's not the case in Venezuela.
Well, but it seems though that with this secrecy, there is denial. And with the denial, there's the inability to create some kind of stable political succession.
There's no question about it. I mean, you know, part of the reason why there, you know, no confirmation about the deterioration of President Chavez's health has been forthcoming is that the moment that's become official, a vicious power struggle will unleash in the ruling party, for sure. And one of the things that one has to remember is that the ruling party is pretty much a single-handed creation of Hugo Chavez. I mean, he pulled together a lot of different political movements and factions that supported his original presidential bid and that have been supporting him over the years. But it's a very heterogeneous creature that I don't think anybody other than President Chavez will be able to keep together.
So, Dr. Kevin Casas-Amor, give us an idea of when you say there'll be a vicious secession battle within the ruling party. I understand his brother, Chavez's brother, who's a governor of one of the provinces, is as close to an heir as possible. But there are other rivals and centers of power in the military and elsewhere. So can you walk us through these centers of power?
Yeah, I mean, his brother is likely to play a crucial role. I don't think that he has anywhere close to the power or the ability to prevail in that struggle. I think there are other political actors. I can mention, for example, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nicolás Maduro, is another important player. And obviously, the biggest question of all, and probably the biggest actor of all in any political transition, will be the military. And what is happening within the military is also very difficult to know at this point. But I can assure you that if push comes to shove and some kind of transition gets underway as a result of the deterioration of President Chavez's health, the key actor to watch will be the military.
So the military, though, there have been reports that some senior officers have been unhappy about the influence of Cuba in the military, particularly Cuban intelligence, in being heavily involved and I guess in a way playing a role in terms of you know, monitoring the possibility of any kind of putsch from the military. I mean, that's clearly what's implied here from what my reading of it.
Yeah, there has been a faction of the military that has been uneasy with the, you know, with a very close relationship with the Cubans. However, they haven't been able to prevail, because ultimately the military, or at least the dominant faction within the military, responds to Chavez. The question is what the reaction will be if they sense that the regime has no future. the fact that Chavez himself might have no future doesn't mean that the military will not try to preserve the very significant influence it has acquired over public policy and the very expansive role it has accrued over the past few years. I mean, they will surely try to preserve that regardless of the future of Hugo Chavez. I mean, there's an institutional interest at stake.
But this is a highly polarized country, Dr. Kevin Casas-Zamora, again, senior fellow in foreign policy in the Brookings Latin American Initiative and formerly Costa Rica's vice president. We're talking about the health of Hugo Chavez and the lack of any secession, even a discussion of a secession. He has obviously been elected. He's popular, particularly amongst his constituency, but he's deeply unpopular amongst a lot of the middle class and, of course, the old ruling elite. But this is a highly polarized country with an incredibly high crime rate. And people that I speak to down there say it feels like they're living in a tinderbox.
Yes, I mean, it is an extraordinarily polarized country. I mean, and actually, it speaks volumes about the strength of the democratic culture of Venezuela that they are not shooting each other. I mean, almost any other Latin American country, save perhaps Costa Rica and Uruguay, maybe, would have had much more significant levels of political violence than Venezuela. Given the level of polarization, I have the impression that the real problem here is that as with any other authoritarian regime, I mean, the real problem is that there are no institutional channels to resolve a succession problem, and what you will have is a power vacuum, because the problem is that the opposition, which has gained in strength and has gained in ability, because they were incredibly clumsy for the first few years of the Chavez tenure, it's also very divided. I mean, they've been able to coalesce. I mean, they were able to to join forces and gain a very significant result in the last congressional election, but the moment that they smell blood and that they smell weakness in the ruling party, I sense that power struggles will also unleash within the opposition. So the real problem here is the risk of a political vacuum taking over Venezuela. And that's why the role of the military is so crucial, because that's the kind of situation in which the military tends to have the last word.
But my understanding is that if it wasn't for a $30 billion line of credit from the Chinese, the country would be in terrible shape. How are they doing in terms of oil revenues? I know there's been a push to nationalize more and more and more of industry there, but the fact that the Chinese have had to bail them out suggests that the economy may be fragile.
The economy is in dire straits. Venezuela has had the highest inflation in Latin America for quite a few years now, and it continues to be the only country other than Haiti, if I recall correctly, that is yet to record positive economic growth after the economic crisis. I mean, all the rest of the region, all the rest of Latin America has grown very nicely, has rebounded very nicely after the economic crisis. Venezuela is still mired in negative growth, and as I said, I mean, the only country that shares that that trend is Haiti. So that tells you something about the Venezuelan economy. The economy is very fragile, and the Chinese have played a role of lenders of last resort. But, I mean, I don't think they're willing to, I mean, they're going to hedge their bets. They're going to hedge their bets. I don't think that they're going to continue bailing Chavez out. The intention of the Chinese is very explicit and is to secure future supplies of oil. And it's actually very interesting when you read the fine print of the contract that have been signed between the Chinese National Bank and the Venezuelan government. They actually, the Chinese put a lot of pressure on the Venezuelans to make sure that the loan was approved by Congress in such a way that they could demand repayment from any future government of the country. It was not done at the whim of the president.
Very interesting.
So that tells you that the Chinese, yes, they're willing to support Chavez, but only to the extent they managed to secure future supplies of oil, and only to the extent that is the Venezuelan government, the Venezuelan state as such, that is bound by this relationship, not Chavez.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Kevin Casasamora.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Casasamora as a senior fellow in foreign policy in the Brookings Latin American Initiative. Most recently, he served as Costa Rica's vice president as well as minister of national planning and economic policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to the filmmaker of a new film that opens tomorrow, You Betcha, about who else but Sarah Palin.
From Alaska, ingrained with common sense. She's not a Harvard lawyer, but she knew what the founders meant. A cold blast from the north that freezes Congress in their tracks. With God and the Tea Party, she's gonna take it back. Sarah Palin, she won't listen.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is British documentarian Nick Broomfield, whose latest feature documentary, Sarah Palin, You Betcha, opens in theaters tomorrow. He is the recipient of a number of awards, including the Sundance First Prize, the British Academy Award, Prix Italia, and many more. His best-known works include Kurt and Courtney, Soldier Girl, Eileen, The Life and Death of a Serial Killer, Tracking Down Maggie, and Hollywood Madam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nick Broomfield.
Hi, how do you do, Ian?
Good to talk to you, Nick. And your film that opens tomorrow, you actually did some serious legwork on this, months and months up in Wasilla, Alaska.
Serious legwork with lots of thermal underwear on.
I know. You're dressed up there like like an out-of-place lumberjack.
Right.
So the title of your film comes from the exchange you had with Sarah Palin as she's signing books. And you ask her whether you can make a documentary about her, and she replies in a that sort of homey, sunny way, "You betcha."
Exactly. She was very charismatic and didn't seem to have a care in the world. It seemed very welcoming, so we were really looking forward to spending time with her and her family and hanging out a bit.
Well, you did that in a way. You didn't get to see her, obviously. Maybe she looked at your bio. But you spent a lot of time with her parents and her
yes.
friends, and it seems like, and I think that's what's clever about the film, is that you start off, you know, being very sympathetic, and then through the mouths of the people in Wasilla, after you've met all of her friends and family who support her unconditionally, then a whole other picture emerges.
Well, yes, I didn't go there. I made the film with Joan Churchill, and we went there with a very open mind. We didn't go there to do a hit piece, and we didn't go there to prove a particular point. I'd never been to Alaska before, and I knew very little really about Sarah Palin, except that she seemed to represent this enormous change that's taken place in the Republican Party, which is that the evangelical right is now so powerful, which is obviously why she was McCain's running mate in the first place. So I knew I wanted to find out more about the evangelicals and what it was like to grow up as an evangelical, which is obviously what Sarah Palin did.
Well, but isn't there an irony here? In the town of Wasilla that has a population of 6,000, there are 76 churches, and it's also the crystal meth capital of Alaska.
It's a very, very small, kind of inbred community. Everybody knows everything about everybody else, which actually made the film quite difficult to make, because a lot of people, although they were very welcoming and we ate lots of moose sausage and everybody had their own recipe for making king salmon, they were reluctant to talk out because they didn't want to upset other people in the community. And the people who did talk out were people at that point, a year ago from today, people really believed that Sarah Palin was the Republican front runner and that she stood a very good chance of getting the Republican nomination. I mean, we've shifted a long way from that. But ultimately, that was what got them to talk.
Again, I'm joined by British documentarian Nick Broomfield, whose latest feature documentary, Sarah Palin, You Betcha, opens in theaters tomorrow. So it's true that she has somewhat faded, and she's been somewhat eclipsed by Michelle Bachmann's surge.
Perry and Governor Perry, I guess.
Yes, but Bachmann is now, sort of fading rather rapidly, and there's, I think, about a day left before you'd have to file for the Florida primaries. So the clock is ticking, but that doesn't mean there's not a lot of people out there wanting her to run, as they do want Governor Christie to run.
I think that's possible. I mean, I kind of think her validity has really gone. And although I hate to say it, I think the fact that she slept with a black man is the thing that's going to cost her most support. And although personally, I found it actually rather wonderful that she could let off her own steam by maybe sniffing a bit of cocaine and letting down a hair, this is not going to be the kind of behavior that's going to go down well with her evangelical supporters, particularly in the South. And although one might consider it a rather low blow, I think it's something that's going to cause enormous problems for her political career in the future and the kind of scrutiny that she would be put through if she was indeed going to run.
Well, you're referring to the book by Joe McGinnis, right? That's
right.
One of the revelations in the book that
right.
She's, I think, was he a football player or a basketball player or somebody?
He was a basketball player. Big meaning tall.
And he McGinnis rented a house next door to her and was there for a long time.
Mm.
And what was the residue in the town? I mean, you're coming after McGinnis has already tainted the well, haven't you, in terms of outsiders coming to town to trash the local beauty queen?
I don't think that was really the problem. I think that there was just a fear in Wasilla of talking out. Because, for example, I got to know some people very well who, for example, worked in the local coffee shop. And they were frightened of talking out because most of their customers were from the Assembly of God, which was the evangelical church that Sarah Palin and her family belonged to. And they were frightened of losing those customers, because if they lost those customers, they would cease to exist as a coffee shop. So there was that kind of thing. It was kind of almost like they were very powerful within the business community. So there were lots of reasons people didn't talk out. Sometimes in a particular family, the kids were friends with, say, the Palin kids, and they didn't want their parents to talk out. So, it's a teeny little town. where loyalties ran very deep. Nothing to do with Joe McGinnis and the fence.
So the McGinnis book, of course, has prompted her to threaten to sue the book, The Rogue, and but she hasn't. Has she threatened you in any way?
We received some cursory lawyer's letters at a certain point, which we didn't take seriously, and I don't think one can take the threat seriously with the book either. She would never want anyone to go on a stand and start taking the oath and having to talk, because I think she stands too much to lose. But I think it's just a saber-rattling exercise, really.
So tell me about Nick Broomfield, The Flying Monkeys.
Right. The Flying Monkeys are, it's the term taken from The Wizard of Oz, where the flying monkeys are sent out by the Wicked Witch of the, is it the East or the West?
Well, there were a couple of them, but I think...
Exactly.
I think one of them was bad.
And they're sent off to harass the... Well, in Palin's case, what she would do, for example, is to blog, for example, with, Joe McGinnis or somebody else she didn't care for. This guy has just moved next door to me and is looking at Piper playing in the paddling pool. And people would then find out where Joe McGinnis was, or find out, where, for example, there was a blogger called Jesse Griffin who had reported on the bus stop or fights between in the Palin marriage, and the location of his gym and the location of his the school where he taught were also given in this website. And people then called up the school and said that he was a pedophile, and called up and threatened to shoot him in the playground, in the school playground. His gym was contacted, and he was unable to really go there anymore. Frightening, harassing behavior, which happened fairly consistently to people who talked out. And this was something, I think, that made people very worried about stating what they thought.
Again, I'm speaking with Nick Broomfield, whose film is just coming out tomorrow, the film Sarah Palin, You Betcha, which he co-directed with Joan Churchill. Did the Flying Monkeys give you any trouble?
The Flying Monkeys didn't give us any trouble. We were actually on our best behavior in Wasilla. We really didn't ruffle too many feathers. I mean, as I say, we became close to the Palin family. We became as close as we could to friends of hers. We didn't go around saying derogatory things. Our attempts were really to make a portrait of the community that she had grown up in, and allow people to talk for themselves, to say what they thought. So, we rented a house and fitted into the community as best we could, and we left just before Christmas. I came back and did a little bit more filming. But at that point, we really didn't have any trouble at all. It was only, later on, I think Murdoch's people got wind that we'd been there, and some nasty pieces came out in things like the Daily, the iPad Daily. Rupert Murdoch's been a great supporter of hers. So it was more in that area that we started to encounter problems. And obviously, the Murdoch press is extremely powerful and has long arms and tentacles. So I think that's the kind of problem we're more likely to face.
Well, you did go to as far afield as Egypt, did you not, in terms of filming?
We did. We went to Egypt because one of the few, many, many people who went to school with Sarah Palin talked to us off record. And they told us lots of things about her, but they weren't prepared to be seen visually on film. And we really needed somebody to talk out. So we, the one school friend who would talk out, who was on the basketball team with her, called Yvonne Bachelier, lived in Alexandria, was married to an Egyptian doctor, and we went out there actually shortly before the revolution, just days before the revolution, and she told us really what it was like growing up in an evangelical community. Apparently, if you weren't, for example, in the Assembly of God, it was very hard to be on the basketball team, which is the kind of thing that I would never have imagined possible. But there was that kind of pressure put on people. And she gave us a very strong sense of just what it was like to grow up in a very, very narrow-minded community like that, as particularly if you didn't fit in. And I think that that, although it was about something that happened a long time ago, it also indicates, I think, a lot about, you know, Sarah Palin's thinking and her philosophy and her outlook on life and why she holds certain views so tight and so strongly. And I think it's very, I think when you're doing these kinds of films or when you're doing biographies, I always think back to that old Jesuit maxim, give me a person for the first 7 years of their lives and I will show you the man, in this case the woman. And I think, you know, when we interviewed Yvonne in Egypt, we just got a sense of the power of religion, which I guess more and more has become such a dominant thing in Republican politics. And it's something that is so prevalent as we move towards 2012.
Well, whether or not she runs, Nick Broomfield, and of course, as I mentioned, she's running out of time to file, although I think she is very ambitious, but she's also not authentic in a very fundamental sense. And you get that in the scene where in your film where you go to Lemoore up in the Central Valley, which is right next to a big Navy base, a very conservative community where, you know, she promised to have Q&A from the audience. And, of course, everything was orchestrated and all the questions were softball. And you tried to make stand up and ask a question and they took you out and roughed you up and roughed up. Did they rough up Joan, who was shooting?
Roughed up. We actually had a couple of cameras there, and they grabbed one of the cameramen, Mark, bashed him up against the wall, and got him in a half Nelson. It was quite awful to watch. And it didn't seem to occur to them they couldn't just take the footage off him. They would need to actually get a court order in order to do so, that we still live in a democracy and, you know, certain things have to be done legally. You can't just...
But if she becomes president, I'd hold my breath on what kind of a democracy, because that's why when I say she's not authentic, that it's quite simply that when she first had to do what all politicians have to do, which is be interviewed by the press, not just in a control circumstance, but in either in a press conference situation, which she's never done, by the way, never done a press conference, but she did have to talk to CBS and Katie Couric, ask her very reasonable questions, and she was completely incapable of answering them. And that seems to be the case, that if you actually manage to get a one-on-one with her, she's absolutely there's nothing there. But in these control situations, she's able to project this homey, charismatic character.
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And ironically, I mean, she studied media when she went to university, but is complete distrustful of the media and
but for good reason, because she, you know, the real person, there's nothing there from what I can tell. Or if it, what's there is not particularly attractive. Let me not put words in your mouth. What was your final conclusion? Because the film does, as I say, it starts out very sympathetically and then through the experiences of people that have known her for years and years and worked with her, you start to get a rather dark image.
Well, I think from the sort of bubbly person that you see, and she certainly has that persona when you meet her. She's extremely engaging and has that quality that I think a lot of people mention about Clinton, that he had that ability to make you think you're the special person and to make you feel you have the undivided attention. Sarah Palin definitely has that ability. But when you speak to a lot of her colleagues who worked with her for 20, 30 years, you know, I mean, John Bitney was somebody, for example, who worked with her, was in the school band with her originally and worked with her when she was governor. One little thing, and you suddenly are on the enemy list. And not just on the enemy list, but and fired from your job, but Sarah Palin seems to have that desire that you will never work for anybody else as well. And so I think, you know, one of her distinguishing characteristics, I think, is that she has this a need that I guess Howard Bass, the pastor, talked about, to kill people, to just sort of finish them off. And I think it partly goes back to her sort of evangelical God and the devil kind of good and bad attitude. But also, I think, you know, when I think John Bitney said, you know, if I fire somebody, I'll give them a party and make sure that they feel good about leaving and I can have some kind of relationship with them in the future. And I'll leave them with some dignity. But she doesn't operate that way. And I think that sort of small town attitude that Sarah Palin grew up with and which you see very much in the film has simply stayed with her, both when she was governor and you could see it too with the way she dealt with things when she was on the VP campaign trail. And so I think the worry about having somebody like that in power, and I think the same would apply to a Michelle Bachmann or Rick Perry, is that that small-town politics that they embody follows them, and one can't really have someone like that in Washington.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Nick Broomfield.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with British documentarian Nick Broomfield. His latest feature documentary, Sarah Palin, You Betcha, opens in theatres tomorrow. He is a recipient of a number of awards, including the Sundance Film Prize, British Academy Award, Prix Italia, and many more. His best-known works include Kurt and Courtney, Soldier Girl, Eileen, The Life and Death of a Serial Killer, Tracking Down Maggie, and Hollywood Madam. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program's available at ianmasters.com for podcasting. You can sign up. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Next door in 305.